Hey, Don, I heard Dallas saying that any monkey could do our theme song, so you want to give it a shot?
Let's do it.
All right, ready? One, two, three.
Whoa, 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 two dimension.
Well, I guess we weren't the monkeys he was talking about.
All right, Two Dimension Podcast, episode 21.
And you are?
Al.
And I'm Don.
And we are Al and Don. So what are we going to talk about, man? We're going to talk about these Watchmen, these new Watchmen.
Well, one thing that came up, I heard a rumor, other podcasts that talked about it, was the Watchmen prequel. And when I first heard about it, it was just like when Ted Turner was colorizing those black and white movies in the 80s, you know.
Right.
And I just thought, well, I mean, I really liked Watchmen. I think most of us like Watchmen. And it was a thing unto itself. And I just had no interest in reading what anybody else would do. And then it was always rumor people talked about. You'd hear certain names of creators, you know, were putting this together and doing that or masterminding it. And I just thought, well, you know, they can do whatever they want. A lot of times I find I don't really want to read stuff like the New 52 or something they mentioned. But I'm sure somebody else will. Well, I guess it was 2 days ago, it was all over the internet, all the covers to the series. And I hate to admit it, but I was interested in reading a couple of them. And the other ones, I thought looked really nice too. So, I don't know, I mean, I hate to turn tail on it. It's a prequel to the Watchmen series, but basically it's, I don't know if I'd really say a prequel, it just looks like it's a series about each individual character. The one I was interested in, I like Darwin Cook, and he's doing six issues of the Minutemen, and it just looks like, you know, a fun, neat-looking comic.
Now, of course, Alan Moore has nothing to do with this.
No, well, Alan Moore, he discontinued all of his work with DC. I think he even gave the rights to Watchmen to Dave Gibbons. He just disavowed everything. But no, he has nothing to do with it.
Well, I mean, from looking at the covers, they do look nice. I mean, you know, like they said, you can't judge a book by its cover, but these covers look really good, so you might want to check them out online. I'm pretty sure they're out there, right?
Well, the covers are. I was looking for interiors, and if they are there, I haven't seen them yet. I've just seen the covers that they announced for, I don't know how many series they have. Is it six of them?
Six, I think.
And each series I saw, some of them are four-issue series and some of them are six-issue series.
Now, these books are probably not going to get involved with the Charlton origins of these characters.
I couldn't tell you.
And you were telling me something that before that Paul Levitz didn't want to do it, and as soon as he... I didn't even know he left DC. As soon as he got was not involved in it,
yeah.
Now they're coming to light.
Yeah, well, it's what I've heard on other podcasts is every time anybody brings something like this up, Paul Levitz says, no, the Watchmen is the thing unto itself, and he wouldn't allow him to do it. I don't think Alan... From what I understand, Alan Moore did have other projects, and he had a Watchmen prequel, you know, before that. And, you know, he had plans... That Making Watchmen book that Dave Gibbons put out had all of Alan's scripts in it, had the thumbnails, sketches, character designs, all the publicity photos of the two creators. And I thumbed through it at the bookstore. They had pictures of the Charlton characters with the Watchmen characters on a big anthology book with all the Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman. Dave Gibbons drew it. But it seemed more like a mainstream superhero title type mm-hmm. thing than what it became.
Yeah.
And so, like I said, even though it's its own thing now, I don't think he always intended it to be.
I saw I looked at that one page and it looked like They did some role-playing games with the Watchmen.
Well, that's what they brought up before, was that Alan Moore also got involved with the role-playing game. He wrote a lot of parts for it, and There was a couple other things he did for it. You know, I mean, he didn't mind doing it, and he liked to do it.
Right.
Basically, the whole thing with the Watchmen was Alan Moore had a... Basically, they wrote up a contract that he would get on... Once it stopped publication, the rights would revert back to him and Dave Gibbons. And at the time, as Alan and I always talk about when we were growing up, the comics had a shelf life of like 3 months at the newsstands. You find them at convenience stores. And then once that was gone, that was it. Later on, I started finding about conventions and comic stores and stuff in the later 70s. But basically, if you missed the issue, that was it, unless you could be lucky enough to find it in a used bookstore or a garage sale or somebody else had it and you could trade them, you know, for it. But if you missed it, you missed it. And the comics industry is still pretty much the same way when Watchmen came out. So Alan Moore just figured, you know, they'd do it. They might go back to a few different printings, but eventually it would just stop. And they put it into a trade paperback. And basically, I understand that's when they started putting story arcs together in trade paperbacks. And it's continuously been in print since 1986. They've never stopped. And he realized it never was going to stop. So I guess that was a loophole that... I don't know if that was the intention of DC Comics the whole time or not, but it's never gone out. And so they retained the rights to it, and it's not going to stop. V for Vendetta, he started with a Warrior magazine in England, and it never finished. And he brought it to DC back in 1987, I think it was. Or 88, and they reprinted it and, you know, finished it up in 12 issues, and it was the same type of thing. Once it went out of print, then the rights would go back to him, and it never has either. And then they put it out and licensed it out for movies and stuff, which he didn't particularly care for.
I don't think he's liked any of the movies made.
No, he's not a... He basically looks at it, what he wrote for the comics, and that was about it. I know he worked on a movie project with Malcolm McLaurin, you know, the manager of the Sex Pistols. And he said he did it because he wanted a chance to work with Malcolm McLaurin. And other than that, that's about all he's ever done. I know in Watchmen, him and Dave Gibbons were playing a lot with storytelling, things that were unique to comic books that wouldn't translate and weren't meant to translate to other mediums. So, I know V for Vendetta, he got really upset because they basically changed the philosophy of the story, you know, mm-hmm. to fit the movie. But
well, he didn't like Watchmen either.
Yeah, well, I didn't either. Have you seen it?
Yeah, you guys gave me a copy of it and I watched it, yeah. I thought it was good. I mean, we were talking on the last episode about how movies are different from the comic books and sometimes... You know, we don't really like the changes made. But The Watchmen was a book that I liked, but it wasn't like one of the key books like when I was a kid. So I saw the movie for what it was, an interpretation of it. And it wasn't bad. I liked it.
It wasn't bad. As we talked about in the past, I was shocked when I see pictures online. I was really excited about the movie because it looked like the comic. I mean, as far as the visual look of it, I just found it staggering. The problem I had with it was it seemed like they took some of the superficial things of it and focused on that and didn't show the rest of it. Like the little boy reading the comic book and the news vendor, you know, that was all gone. They showed him a little bit, but, you know, that whole thing, bringing it up, that's what made it unique. And, the whole part with the psychiatrist, you know, how he's taking care of Rorschach in the prison. He was there, but they didn't show exactly what was happening to him. You know, Rorschach told another prisoner, "I'm not trapped in here with you. You're trapped in here with me." And you're showing all the violence in the prison and what was happening. Well, then it went on and had it was showing how this psychiatrist was basically consuming his life. It started out, he was talking about how this is going to make his career, you know, he could write a paper and get published and really pick him up on the fast track. And as it goes on, basically that's all he thinks about is Rorschach. He gets tied up in all the stories Rorschach told. He ends up destroying dinner parties. His wife gets upset. It starts, destroying his career and his marriage. He finally had to just leave the whole job. You know, he couldn't do it with Rorschach anymore. But they didn't show that in the film. It was just, I understand it's a 2-hour film.
Right.
But visually how they looked at it, made it look, was fantastic. But then the other parts, one thing Alan Moore was talking about in it, and Dave Gibbons worked really hard to show, was violence. Like, in one bar, Rorschach was breaking a man's fingers. And it wasn't like you always read in superhero comics where there's a bunch of jumping and smashing and stuff. But it's more of a subtle violence, real type thing. But in the movie, it was just the opposite. It was, part of it too is my wife went, she mentioned, did I want to go see the movie? I said, yeah, so she went with me. And she was horrified at some of this stuff.
Sure.
And I was kind of embarrassed because it wasn't the way the comic was, So I don't know. It looked good, and there was things. Now Dallas loves the film, He bought it on DVD, and then he went and bought it on Blu-ray and gave me the DVD. And I thought, well, I'll try it again. So I watched it at home, and I only got so far and lost interest again. It hasn't changed for me. But there's some people, like anything, there's some people that just absolutely love it, But
now I saw at I think it was at a Big Lots, they had an animated version of it. I think it was that animated version where they use the panels and then they do like a 3D.
Oh yeah, the motion comic.
Right, and that was that's an adaptation of the graphic novel.
Yeah,
right? That's not anything different or any story or anything.
No, they brought Dave Gibbons in on that. He worked, on the movie. He worked on everything, and I guess he was telling Alan that it's not like your other times in Hollywood. They're really trying hard to be faithful to it, which they were. They did try to be faithful. But the motion comic, Dave Gibbons went in and re-illustrated some parts, like the electric cars. I guess I've never seen it. I've only heard about it. But the electric cars would go past from one panel to the next. Mm. And in some of these, in the original drawings, it's only part of the car, So Dave Gibbons went in and finished some of the flying cars or whatever they had, the electric cars driving across, stuff, balloons or whatever, blimps in the sky. He'd go on and finish the drawings so they could animate those. But I've heard people liked it, but I've never seen it.
Now, why was, back to the beginning of The Watchmen, Alan Moore's original intention was to use the Charlton characters and do this. Why did DC decide don't use them? Did they have all these? They didn't want to kill them off, basically, or they didn't want to destroy them?
The plan was DC bought the Charlton superheroes they had, which was the Question, Blue Beetle, Peacemaker. What were the other two? Thunderbolt.
Yeah, it was Thunderbolt. It was the Question. It was. And you said Peacemaker.
The lady.
Was it?
There was a lady. I don't know that character.
Oh, yeah, I forgot her name. Okay, we'll put
that,
it on.
Yeah, that was basically the Charlton characters. And Alan Moore had this whole plan to do it. And I don't know exactly if it just developed into what it became, but DC finally looked at it and says, well, this is something completely unique in itself. And I guess they had plans to just put the Charlton characters in the regular mainstream. And they basically just looked at it, well, you should make something different. They wanted to reuse the Charlton characters. And like I said, as Paul Levitz, they say, was really adamant about, was it was a thing unto its own. So they basically created, what do you call it, animograms?
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about, yeah.
Basically their own thing, but it was based on them. You could tell, but... they set it up that way, and it became its own story.
Well, Paul Levitz bought it and kind of gave him as a present to Dick Giordano, correct? Like I had heard a story of Paul Levitz said to Dick Giordano, hey, I just bought the old Charlton heroes, and, here they are.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, I thought you were the one who told me. Okay, yeah, no, there is a story. I'm pretty sure it's true that because don't you remember for a while there, there was a time when Charlton went out of business. I think Bill Black put out an issue of his, forgot what it was called, but it was the Charlton Superheroes, because he thought they lapsed into public domain. And I think they may have, but then all of a sudden, I've heard the story, well, Paul Levitz went and bought the rights, and since Giordano was the editor of DC, he goes, hey, look what I did. I just got you the Charlton Heroes, so you can, you know, start them all over again. I don't know how and when Alan Moore got involved with it. It could have been around the time when he was doing Swamp Thing. Because I think the early 80s was when the Charlton went out of business. I'm pretty sure about 82 or 83.
Yeah, because they did that Ditko book, Static. What's it called?
Yeah, Static. Yeah.
Yeah, because they were around in, I think, 84. And basically it was like a last gasp. It didn't seem like the comic was out. Maybe it was in the newsstands. But Steve Ditko, they gave him complete freedom, and he was really putting a lot of stuff out.
They did the book, the original. Well, no, the original was a fanzine called Charlton Bullseye, but they redid a book called Charlton Bullseye, early 80s, where basically young creators would go and do a free book for them, and they would publish it for you, and you had your first shot at getting into comics through them. They didn't pay you anything, but I guess around that time they were, business was already, bad for them. But the story was Levitz bought them.
Yeah, it makes sense because Dick Giordano was a creator for them, and later became the editor in chief, I think.
Yeah, he was the main guy. I remember him doing Sarge Steel and a lot of the Judo Master. Now, they didn't do Judo Master in the Watchmen. I remember that guy.
Yeah, well, some of those, I don't know. There was another one called Yang.
Yang, that's right. I forgot about him. Sanho Kim.
Yeah. And the E-Man comic, that went to first. I don't know exactly how that worked. And John Byrne got the rights to his robot, Raj 2000, which was published in Charlton in the
early 70s. Really know how that... We should know. We will know.
Well,
we will know for the next episode, but now...
They didn't take them all, but the five heroes. I remember it was 84 is when they did that Static, the Steve Ditko book. In 85, the Charlton characters were in DC, The Crisis on Infinite Earths.
That's right.
And then after that, they started the Blue Beetle monthly comic, and The Question came out not long after that, too.
That's right.
I was within a year.
But there was one issue of America. I think it was America Comics, that's it. And they brought the Charlton Heroes, Bill Black thinking that they were public domain, but after one issue, no.
Yeah, well, they weren't. They hadn't been published in a long time. I mean, they'd been gone. Even though Charlton was around, those characters hadn't been published in years.
Now, Blue Beetle was a 40s character that just kept changing as the years went on.
Yeah, see, I wasn't aware of any of that stuff. I think it was 77 when I found some reprints of those Steve Ditko Blue Beetles.
Oh, those were great.
And it wasn't until the 80s when I found out that there was the original Blue Beetle was Dan Garrett, which I think was a radio show.
Yeah, it was a radio show.
I've never heard it. I've just heard about it. And I've seen some of the old drawings, but completely different character. I guess he had a scarab he found on Pago Island.
And that's right.
When he wore it, he had superpowers. He could fly. He was strong. And when Ted Kord, the Steve Ditko Blue Beetle, he didn't have any of that. He was more like Night Owl in the Watchmen movie. He had a giant beetle he flew around in a ship. He had a costume with all these weapons, and a completely different animal.
And don't forget, in the early 60s, before Ditko, there was the classic Tony Tallarico Blue Beetle. Did you ever see any of those?
No, I didn't. I wasn't aware of
them. I'll show you some of them. I have a couple of them. Yeah, they're a lot of fun.
Was it Charlton as well?
Charlton, yeah. It was, I don't remember if it was Dan Garrett or not. I think that Ted Kord was the Steve Ditko, right? It might have been Dan Garrett. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, Dan Garrett was the original Blue Beetle.
But I'll show them to you. They're kind of fun. I mean, they're done in the typical Tallarico and Bill. I guess the guy with the pencil he worked with, his name was Bill Fraccio. Yeah, it's done in their typical fun style, but yeah, they're pretty cool, definitely.
Huh. No, I've never seen
them. Yeah, I'm thinking that the Charlton, the female was called Lady something or other. That's going to kill me. Well, I'll back when we come back from break, we'll give you the...
Well, I never, like I said, I've never seen... I knew the Blue Beetle and I knew the Question because Steve Ditko did them.
Nightingale? No, that was the Watchmen character, was it?
Nightshade or something, maybe.
Nightshade, that was it. I think that was it.
I've never seen that. I've never seen Peacemaker, and I've never seen Thunderbolt. I've seen them since, you know, illustrations, but...
Peacemaker was Pat Boyette.
Was it?
Yeah. And Thunderbolt, I'm pretty sure it was drawn by Pete Molinari. I think he went under the PAM acronym.
I've never seen those. Peacemaker, when DC bought the Charlton characters, I think he appeared in Crisis. The headpiece I always thought was neat.
Yeah.
But I see drawings like that, but I never read any of the books, new or old. And I always thought that was an odd name, Peacemaker, and the guy's running around with firearms.
Kind of ironic, but yeah, I think one of the shows I want to talk about Charlton a little bit, because I do... love those comics in retrospect. They were kind of like the, if Marvel and DC were like the big studios, they were kind of like the, you know, the American International Pictures or something like that of their
Their
time.
They were always third rate. I bought some.
Oh, yeah, because of Ditko.
And I remember when I was in middle school, you know, some guys were collecting. Basically, it was all Marvel, you know, or maybe some DC. But they wouldn't touch Charlton. And if you did ever buy one, why are you wasting your time? But there were some people that absolutely loved them. I know in, I guess it was 75, they started using what looked like painted covers. They used to have the Phantom. I guess they had the license to the Phantom.
Yeah, Don Newton did some of those painted covers.
Yeah, but I remember there was one where he was on the cover with a wolf. And
I bought that one. That was awesome.
I saw that at a U Totem store, me and my best friend.
Yeah, there you go.
And I was like, well, look at this. And I was holding it, kind of amazed, and my friend looked at it and said, and you think Charlton Comics are sorry? Well, yeah, I did. I mean, sometimes they were really third, fourth-rate comics, but that cover was staggering. And then after that, they started using some painted covers. And some of the comics, like my brother used to get Space 1999, which John Byrne did.
Oh, yeah.
And I ended up buying a couple of the books myself. But he did painted covers, but they were with markers. And to this day, they're staggering.
Well, the Space 1999 magazine, a lot of it was by Gray Morrow. A lot of nice Gray Morrow covers and a lot of, you know, 10-page stories by Gray Morrow. So those were always... excellent.
Charlton, yeah, Charlton did the magazines, too.
They did a $6 billion Man magazine, too, and the art in that was by the Continuity Studio, so you got a lot of nice Neil Adams and Dick Giordano, of course. And
Terry Austin, Steve Austin, all those guys.
Yeah, Pat Broderick, everybody like that. So those were actually pretty nice, but when you're talking about the painted covers, yeah, Don Newton did the Phantoms, but then in the horror books, Tom Sutton, one of my unsung hero guys, did a lot of nice painted covers for those, like Scary Tales and all that stuff. Those were beautiful.
Well, I had heard about Charlton, the printing press they used to print the comics were also the same printing presses that they ran cereal boxes off of.
Yeah, they were their own printing press.
Yeah, so, yeah, like I said, they did some of those magazines you mentioned, some of them were staggering. And then I remember some of them, not so much. That first $6 million Man, you know, Continuity Associates did. I've got that one. I still have it. It's staggering. But years later, I bought another one, and not so much.
I think the four-color comic book was by Joe Staton. I think he drew the four-color comic book, but the magazine was by Continuity. But Aparo did the Phantom also before Don Newton, and there was a few issues that they did of... Jungle Jim, I think it was, and I just found out who the penciler was, Roger Brand, but the inker was Wally Wood, and those are great, man. I've got a couple of those. Those are wonderful. So yeah, you know, they were kind of like hit and miss. You'd get a good one every once in a while. I mean, whenever Giordano did Sarge Steel, that was always nice. And of course, another one of my guilty pleasures was the art team of Charles Nicholas and Vince Alessia, who did tons of stuff for them. They were kind of like, kind of generic looking, but it's like, that's like Charlton to me, you know?
Yeah. They did, but there was some. I like John Byrne's Doomsday Plus One.
Right.
And I liked the Space 1999 work, and I liked E-Man.
Yeah.
The rest of them, not so much.
Now, I got this bad boy here on the computer. I'll show it to you later. It's a issue of a romance magazine that they did called My Only Love. It's number 3. It's got a rockin' Alex Toth story in it. I didn't know he did much work for him, but it's awesome. I'll show it to you later on. So every once in a while, they go off the deep end and get somebody great in there.
Well, it's, you know, going back to the Watchmen prequel, I think they're calling it Before Watchmen. And there was an article today. It was in what's called The Devil's Advocate. It says, Before Watchmen continues 80 years of creator exploitation. And basically talk about how they stole the rights, you know, from everything. And they brought up Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster with Superman. And that's one thing that always gets to me, is creators' rights and how they lost everything. You know, we're talking about some of the Charlton work. Some of the creators of those ended up moving E-Man or Raj 2000 somewhere else, or just retaining the rights to it. One of the questions they had in the book was, or this short article, was people don't understand why Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster signed all the rights away to national periodical publications at the time. And a lot of it was they just figured they'd come up with other stuff as well, which they did some, but never with any success. Superman basically changed everything. I think basically, if you ever look at anything that, you know, the United States has processed that, you know, the whole world looks at, it's Superman and Mickey Mouse. And, like I said, those two creators never really came up with too much of anything else that stuck. When they were talking about the creators' rights to those two men, I guess...
Siegel and Shuster.
Yeah, Siegel and Shuster. But not Mickey Mouse and Superman.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Disney definitely, he held on to his character for sure.
Well, the thing I was wondering about was when the heirs to, you know, Jerry Siegel was fighting for the rights, DC's had a lot of trouble with it, because the judge did give rights to so much of it before a certain time. And I just started thinking, even though those old Superman stories are neat before, I love a lot of the stuff that started happening later on, like in the 50s. You know, the Bottle City, Kandor, all those Kryptonite stories. Kryptonite wasn't something that was in, I guess that was introduced in the radio program.
Right.
As we spoke before, the original Superman couldn't fly. He jumped around all over the place. And, that's why they said leap tall buildings in a single bound. All the X-ray vision, heat vision, all that stuff, that came later on too. But I was surprised to find out that stuff was, it did come later, but it's when Jerry Siegel came back to DC Comics.
Oh, okay.
He basically after he left, he tried different things with not much success. You know, he had a wife and a daughter. And at one point, the wife went and shamed Jack Liebowitz, you know, the guy in charge of the place, to do something for him. You know, he created that they made so much money off, and he was starving, they were barely making it. So Liebowitz talked to Moore Weisinger, you know, the editor of Superman. So Weisinger brought him in. And then they were kind of amazed at what he was coming up with. That's where the whole mythos of... Superman basically mourning the death of Krypton, you know, losing his parents. I remember as a kid reading some of those stories, the pathos to that was just fantastic. But that was all Jerry Siegel. And a lot of that stuff, I think the Bottle City Kandor was his, along with all these other things that made him great.
Yeah, well, unlike Bob Kane, who cut a good deal when, you know, I created Batman, they didn't. And that, a lot of that happens, you know, when you, I watch some of these behind the music shows on TV, and a lot of musicians in the early days, they didn't even own their, the Beatles didn't own their music.
No.
Elton John didn't own his, maybe a portion of it. I mean, he got into, I was watching something, he got into some, you know, horrible legal deal with Dick James Music, which I think was involved with the Beatles, too. And, you know, after the court case, he ended up owning most of it, but it killed Dick James, basically, because he was an old man and, you know, had to go to court and, like, defend it. So a lot, but at any rate, a lot of these guys didn't own their stuff. They were young. They signed deals. They wanted to, you know, they wanted to get a job. I mean, and they did, and, you know, the rest is history.
Well, you know, I honestly would have done the same thing. Yeah. You know, when you're young, well, even now, you're a trusting person. You know, mm-hmm. You expect people to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And I think some of these people that, you know, the publishers and stuff, I don't think they felt they were doing anything wrong. You know, one time I was talking about history. There was a guy I worked with that had been a history professor, and he was talking about how a lot of people these days in history get slandered. And he kept bringing up men like Cortez, who were great men that accomplished great things. And people just look at it like they were, you know, horrifying human beings that completely destroyed. Well, you know, they did bad things. But this one woman said, well, right is right. And he looked at her and says, no, it's not. It depends on the world and environment you're at. Right is right, but you also have to look at the world and the conditions you're in. I guess it'd be like now, if you ever talked about Nelson Mandela. In the future, people say, you know, Nelson Mandela was a great man, but he drove a car with an internal combustion engine that destroyed the environment. Well, you know, that's what you do now. You know,
yeah.
In the future, they'd look at it differently.
Yeah.
But as far as that, if they would have retained the rights to it, I always wonder if any of that would have ever happened. And, you know, if Superman would have gotten past.
Yeah, that's the history, man. That's the story.
Yeah, just a little bit. And I do like some works that other people did on top of, you know, mm-hmm. John Byrne and Chris Claremont and their X-Men work. Dave Cockrum on his Legion of Superheroes and the X-Men work. Walt Simonson on Thor. He didn't create it, but, you know, he went in and did, you know, fantastic stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I like the work some people came in and went on with. But I guess part of the problem now is things seem to have gotten stagnant. Again, back to Alan Moore, he always complains about he wrote a couple of short Green Lantern stories for their annuals back in the 80s. I remember one was pretty neat because this one Green Lantern was sent to a new sector because they had somebody just entered the Corps, and she had to go indoctrinate them. So she went, and it was just basically a barren asteroid. And when she, there was nothing on the surface. She ended up going, there was all these caverns inside, and there was a creature that couldn't see. He lived in the dark. He didn't have eyes. And so she had to explain to him, you know, that he was going to be, you know, a Green Lantern, and he was waiting for him. So she had to explain to him about the green power ring works with light. Well, the ring couldn't translate for him the concept of light or the concept of green. You know, he says, I don't understand what you're talking about. He couldn't see. He couldn't conceive of it. And it was driving her insane. Finally, she thought about it, and she said, what's a pleasant sound? You know, because green is basically a natural color. It's a pleasing color. It calms you down. And she said, what's a pleasant sound for you, a calm, soothing sound? He said, F sharp. F sharp is the sound he liked. And then she thought about it. So she said in his hand, you know, she said, she put the ring on his finger and said, try to imagine the weight of a bell. And he made a green bell. And so when she said the oath, you know, beware my power, Green Lantern's light, she recited with him and says, beware my power, the F-sharp bell. You know, it was a short story, maybe a 6-page story.
Right.
I thought that was neat. And she went back and explained to the Guardians what she did. And I guess they already knew that there was going to be a problem. And she said, you didn't prepare me for it, but I took care. This is what I did. And it's about told him that you'd be in contact with him. And then they said, we'll try not to keep him in the dark. Which was a joke, because he was in the dark. But, I mean, it was a story I really enjoyed. He wrote another one I never read. Kevin Nolan drew that. It was okay. Really nice.
Okay.
But he wrote another one for another annual that I didn't read. And I guess that's what they based that maxi series, Blackest Night.
That was based on that? Okay.
And Alan Moore came on, on the internet. People were firing off right and left. That he said basically the comics industry is, completely bankrupt of ideas. And he said they're just, recycling old stuff. And he said basically that whole, I think they had a series called Brightest Day and another one called Blackest Night.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
I never read them, but I know they were big. I heard people talking about them. I'd see them in the stores. And he was saying basically they just took that six-page story that he came up with and built these giant series around it. Well, I don't think they're bankrupt. I think basically the companies are just trying to protect their assets, and they're not letting people take chances like they did in the 70s. And to me, I guess that's part of the problem. You can have an idea, but if the idea never gets out, nobody's going to know about it, and you don't build on it.
Right. I don't think they're bankrupt. I'm of the philosophy that it's, I think there was even a song that said that it's not what you do, it's the way that you do it.
Yeah.
I mean, every story has pretty much been told, but it's how you interpret it or maybe put something new into it that makes it interesting. Alan Moore took, I think Fleischer before him did it, but he was one of the ones that basically made comic books a lot darker in a way.
Yeah.
And, that was the twist that he did. It's not like they were that much, they were a lot different. Him and Miller did bring kind of a feel to them, but okay, that's great. Now, somebody else will come along and do something.
Well, Alan Moore, he always would take something somebody else had done and really add to it.
Yeah, he did.
And one thing Alan Davis had mentioned, one of my favorite pieces is when they did Captain Britain in England, that series. Well, what was it, Chris Claremont created it, and Herb Trimpe was drawing it. And then eventually Dave Thorpe and Alan Davis did it. And Alan Davis was talking about it was his first professional work. And then after Dave Thorpe left, Alan Moore came in, and he basically brought up that Alan Moore had a different writing style. It was kind of a dark, gothic Alice in Wonderland, Lewis Carroll type stuff. Well, he had bright, fun moments and things too, but that's how Alan Moore was put together. That's how he looks at. But it's how he puts things together and how he thinks and turns everything sideways is amazing. And I know was really upset that when he did Watchmen, he was hoping everybody would take all the storytelling ideas and stuff he had, him and Dave Gibbons, and instead, all of a sudden, it just made comics really dark. He had a bunch of psychotic characters, and, even Frank Miller. Frank Miller can do really rough, violent stuff, but it doesn't seem so bad. But when other people do it, after The Dark Knight came out, it just seems horrifying,
Yeah.
There's Mobius. When he did The Inkle, it was some rough stuff in the strip. And then, Jordowski wrote another one, basically a prequel to The Inkle, which was really good. I've read it serialized in Heavy Metal when they had a comic book. It was a different European artist who was fantastic. But he was talking about how the world evolved up to that point that the Mobius story came out. Well, I mentioned this to a friend of mine. I said, you've been reading that? He said, yeah, I saw some of them. I said, well, it's pretty good. And he said, yeah. He says, I guess the thing is that when Mobius drew it, even though it was the same subject material, there was something bright and happy about some of it. Even though there was rough Blade Runner type stuff and other. He said, but when this guy does it, even though he's fantastic, it just seemed like you're patrolling in the sewer all the time with no happiness.
Yeah, like a little black humor would help.
Yeah. So, when other people try to do what these men did, they're not them. It doesn't work the same.
Well, it would be besides Moore, there was Neil Gaiman and who did the same kind of spin. And there was a few others, too. They would take, you know, the idea was to take an old DC character and give them a new, well, the Vertigo books, Animal Man and stuff like
right,
that.
Right, they gave a different, completely different slap.
And it was, you know, to me it was interesting for a while, but after a while I kind of longed for, okay, we've done that, let's go back to, you know, the original. I think John Byrne ended up doing the Doom Patrol also.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did the Doom Patrol for a little while for DC, and then he went to IDW, I think he does Star Trek books. I don't even know what he does now, actually, but I know for a while he did the Star Trek books, I should say. So.
Well, you know, Alan Moore, he says now, he has no interest in recycling, you know, their old characters and stuff like that. Well, and that's fine. He's gone on and done his own work, and that's very nice, too. There's some creators that have no interest in doing anything but their own work. The Hernandez brothers.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Even though they did a couple of really neat short stories and strange tales about... Gilbert did one about Iron Man, and Jaime did one about the old Marvel girls. Sue Storm, the Fantastic Four, the Wasp, all that stuff.
Right.
But, you know, they've always done their own and nobody else's. There's some creators, I think, that basically they'd rather just work on stuff that, you know, came before them, Jack Kirby work and everything else. And, I mean, that's fine. I've enjoyed both. I've seen some creators that wanted to do their own stuff, and it's just I had no interest in it. But I sure like it when they take other people's old work and redo it.
Yeah, I mean, if I was doing a book, and maybe one day I will, at any rate, I would try to create my own character, even though it would probably be like similar to something that went before, because I just think it's we need an influx of new characters, regardless of how some people may say the derivative or whatever. As much as I love Daredevil, Iron Man, Captain America, we do need new blood, and I personally believe that we need people from different fields coming into comics to give a different spin on them, because what I'm seeing a lot of times is we're getting people that grew up reading comics, writing comics, or drawing comics, and it becomes kind of like, you know,
inbreeding.
Just, that's the word. So you got to get new people in there to take it to a, you know, you might be reading it might be an Iron Man book, but somebody comes in with a different point of view, and you're like, well, yeah, that's pretty cool. And that's what Alan Moore did, in a sense. I don't think he was a novelist before or anything like that. Not that I know of, anyway.
No, he was just talking about originally he used to write for a Melody Maker, I guess a music magazine.
I didn't know that. Oh, that's cool.
It was, I don't know if it was Melody
Maker. Yeah, the British newspaper, New Musical Express, Melody Maker.
Yeah, it was one of those
like
he worked for. And I know he did... what he wanted to be was an underground cartoonist.
That's right.
He liked the old underground comics from San Francisco and Texas in the 70s. And he had a strip called Maxwell the Magic Cat.
I remember.
Yeah, I've seen, there was one panel I saw where, there's not too much out there. I've seen some others that look kind of like Gilbert Shelton type black and white work, but the Maxwell the Magic Cat, I just saw one, and it was the cat with all these mice, and he's like messing with them, and he had a thought bubble saying, I'm always being told not to play with my food. And I don't know why, it was funny. You know, it's how he drew it and stuff. But
He had a musical group called the Sinister Ducks.
Well, he said one time that he has an interest in a lot of different art forms and likes to do it. And he said, I'm not saying that I'm good at them, all of them, but I like to, you know, stay involved
dabble
in things. But he started realizing it was his writing was what would do it.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah.
But, yeah, when he came on and did Swamp Thing, he completely, it was kind of amazing how he did it. In just a few panels, he completely changed the whole concept of the character.
Pretty much. Was it called The Anatomy Lesson or something?
Yeah, it was just...
Yeah, I remember seeing that at a comic shop, and the guy who was running the store went, look at this. Wow, I've never read anything like this before.
Well, you know, Swamp Thing, when Bernie Wrightson and Len Wein did it, it was major.
It was great.
It was great, and everybody talked about it. And every time I'd look at the strip, all I thought was it was a time that was fantastic, and it was gone. And that was that. You know, the comic stopped. I think they had a couple of cartoonists try to do it after Bernie Wrightson left.
Oh, yeah.
Alcala did one.
Redondo did some.
Oh, did he?
Too.
Yeah.
And they had, towards the end, they tried to turn him into a superhero.
Oh, I got you. But it didn't go on long, and then they stopped it. Well, when I was in college, they brought it back. Thomas Yates drew it.
Those were nice.
And I think Marty Pasco wrote them.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
And a friend of mine picked it up. I said, they're bringing back Swamp
Thing. The Saga of the Swamp Thing.
Yeah, Saga of the Swamp Thing. And, you know, once in a while I'd pick one up. I never religiously collected Swamp Thing, even when Bernie Wrightson did it. And I did get all the reprints. But when they brought it back each time, I don't know, it wasn't really the same. I thought, you know, this is never going to be like it used to be. And then all of a sudden, I started seeing issue after issue at the Navy Exchange. And I thought, well, Swamp, this looks kind of neat. And then somebody said, are you reading Swamp Thing? I says, no. And they said, well, you might be interested. It's pretty good. You might be interested in picking it up. I kept hearing that from everywhere. I go back home, people be telling me this. And it was when Alan Moore took over. And I was reading an interview with Marty Pascal. And he brought up, I guess he wrote E-Man for Joe Staten when it was the first comics.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, I guess he had trouble getting into it because he's not even a human being. He's a beam of light. How can you relate to that? You know, and then he's bringing up Swamp Thing. He says, yeah, they wanted me to write Swamp Thing. I said, it's a plant. How can I, you know, I mean, to him, it just wasn't what he was interested in doing. He said, he's basically a plant that walks around, what, you know. And then later on in the interview, they brought up, he says, I never would have thought of what Alan Moore came up with. And, you know, he was basically tipping his hat. But, you know, it was a different sensibility. But Alan Moore basically made it where it wasn't Dr. Alec Holland in a freak accident. Dr. Alec Holland died. And basically the swamp, you know, just gathered up his personality and he embodied him.
Right.
And, then the stuff that Alan Moore was coming up with just blew my mind. I guess in the old strip, when they had to take Swamp Thing somewhere, he rode in the back of a pickup truck.
I remember.
You know? And then Alan Moore basically said that what happened is he comes back into the swamp, and then he grows somewhere else that he needs to be. The consciousness appears, you know. I thought, what? Of course. It made perfect sense. But, yeah, that's one where it went beyond what the original creators came up with.
But I got to tell you, I bought the, I remember where, it's funny how you remember where you buy things. I was at a flea market, and it was in one of those triple packs, and I bought the original House of Secrets with the first Swamp Thing story, and to me, that's like my favorite one. Those first 11 issues and the House of Secrets, that's like, oh, man. Beautiful rights and art on that, and I think it even like Jeff Jones inked a little bit of one of the issues. Kaluta was involved in it, but
wow, I didn't know that. That makes sense.
Yeah, Alan Moore took it to a different universe, but those early ones were like mind-boggling.
They were fantastic. I brought him into Dallas. He's a huge Alan Moore fan. That's when I read the Swamp Thing stuff was Dallas's collection, and when I brought in the Lynn Wein Bernie Wrightson sets. I never read these before. Well, it's a different animal, but they're just fantastic.
Now, of course, it was Man-Thing for Marvel, which was basically almost, well, a similar origin, not exactly the same.
Hey, he was a neat-looking character. Mike Plug drew those.
Yeah, but you know, the origin one was in an issue of Savage Tales, and Gray Morrow drew it. It's awesome.
So I've never really read. The only time I ever saw Man Thing was in advertisements, and I think a Marvel team up. But I always thought he was a really neat looking character.
Yeah, the Plug ones are great, and the original was something called the Heap.
Yeah.
From the 40s, I think, from Airboy or something.
Yeah, see, the Heap. The only way I knew of that was Mad Magazine. You know, I had the comic book, and they used to do parodies of stuff.
Yeah.
And the magazine itself did They had a summer special or winter special, and they had the comic book inside it. And they had different stories, and they had the Heap story in it. I think, I'm trying to think, I think Mary Severn drew it.
Okay.
Maybe not. I know she did that Melvin in the Jungle, which was in that comic book,
too. That was funny, too, yeah.
But yeah, they had the Heap, and I thought, well, this is that Swamp Thing character.
It was probably a parody of the Heap.
Well, the Swamp Thing started in House of Secrets, and it was just a six
page throwaway
story.
Little story.
Yeah, throwaway story, and people kept writing in and writing in, wanting it. And so, you know, Lynn Wein and Bernie Wrightson came back and did it. But yeah, I think it was a parody on The Heap.
Yeah, I think the Heap was like some 40s character. I don't know the exact origin of it, but I do remember that somehow or another in the 70s, Skywald, who we talked about before, the kind of like a Warren kind of imitator, they had some Heap stories, and they were drawn by, Ross Andrew did some of them, not his best work, but I remember some illustrations by Bill Everett that were kind of cool. So I seem to remember a cover by Bill Everett of the Heap that was pretty cool. He had his own magazine for Skywall, too. It didn't last long, maybe two or three issues. Yeah, well, that was during the time when Swamp Thing and Man Thing were real popular. We remember Marvel got into the horror thing. They had the Man Thing, then they had the Monster of Frankenstein, and then, you know, Tomb of Dracula, which is a great book, and all that
Werewolf
other stuff.
Werewolf by Night.
Werewolf by Night, Ghost Rider, you know, who was turned into a motorcyclist and, you know, is the Rook's favorite character.
Yeah, that's right. He was a cowboy.
Yeah, he was a cowboy. Frazetta even did something. And he was owned by another company. I think Marvel bought the rights along the way. He was a cowboy. And Dick Ayers had drawn some of them in the 60s. But before that, in the 50s, I seem to remember a classic Frank Frazetta Ghost Rider cover where he's like riding the white horse. But yeah, he was a cowboy before that. So they kind of like took, you know, modernized everybody around that time, early 70s.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think back or try to figure out why was it that all these horror comics became so popular in the early 70s? Was it because of Swamp Thing? Was it, I mean, the movies at that point were on TV, but, I mean, you weren't getting any classic, well, I'm not going to say you weren't getting any classic horror movies, but it was definitely like the last great generation of, I'm just wondering whether it was Warren Comics that were selling well that inspired them. I don't know.
I think so, because I know horror comics were always popular, but
yeah, the code killed them. We talked about that before.
Yeah, when the code came in, they stopped it, but then later on, I know they changed. They weren't supposed to be, you couldn't show the decapitations and boiling in oil and stuff.
Right, you can say zombie before, or, you know, or monster. You had to be real. But then as the code changed, they became more.
Well, Marvel was doing all the giant monster stuff, which, and
they were magazines anyway.
Yeah.
And that's how Warren got away with it, because you couldn't do it in a comic book, but you can do it in a magazine.
But yeah, DC had a whole line of those horror comics. But, you know, it's funny. When I was a kid, you know, I just randomly bought comics when I didn't collect them. I'd get scary ones all the time. You know, I was a little kid, like seven, 8 years old. But I remember I had some money, and I went and picked up three of them. And, yeah, they were popular.
Yeah, early 70s, gosh, yeah.
And usually if girls had a comic collection, it was all Casper, Richie Rich, some romance comics, and
Archie,
horror comics.
And Archie.
And, yeah, Archie's and horror comics.
And a few horror comics, yeah.
And a lot of girls read the horror comics.
Yeah, but I just, you know, and especially like around 72, it was like Plug was doing Man Thing. He was doing Monster Frankenstein. He was the horror guy. It's funny how he got to be the one, because he kind of had the Will Eisner kind of style, being an assistant to Will Eisner at some point before he got into Marvel. It's funny how he was the one. He also did Planet of the Apes too. So it's interesting how he became Marvel's like horror guy.
Yeah, well, with Mike Plug, I guess what surprised me was in the 80s when I started seeing his, when he came back to comics. He did some Lone Wolf and Cub covers, and for some odd reason, they looked like Norman Rockwell or Tom Sawyer type work.
Yeah, I remember.
And then I think first was doing Classics Illustrated, and he did something like that too, like Tom Sawyer.
Yep.
And when I thought of Michael Plug, it was exactly what you're talking about. It was the illustrations he did for that Wizard movie, an animated movie.
Mm-hmm.
And The Weird World, the first issue he did for Marvel Comics.
Yep.
And the Man Thing and all that stuff. That's in the Planet of the Apes. That's what I think of
Monster Michael. Frankenstein,
you know.
Ghost Rider.
But I never thought of them. But I think, actually, that's the type of work he likes.
I guess so. I mean, there's another unsung hero that we never talked about, Plug. He came up in the, he did some work for Warren, too, actually. He came up in the early 70s, and he just kind of was like, took off real quick doing all that stuff. I guess, yeah, you're right. Maybe it was the stuff that he liked, because he did do a couple of Vampirella stories before I remember ever seeing him do any work for Marvel. He had that kind of a moody style.
Yeah, it was in the up until the 70s. I remember, I think it was 1976, he did Weird World, that Doug Monk
fantasy thing. Yeah.
And Alex Nino did the finishes to it. And I thought it was beautiful. And then they had that the Weird World, the Warriors of the Shadow Realm, I think it was called.
Right.
And John Buscema drew it, and Rudy Niebuhr inked it, and Peter Ledger airbrushed it. But the original plan was, it was supposed to be Michael Ploog, Alex Nino, and then Peter Ledger would airbrush that. And Michael Ploog just left. And I guess Alex Nino wasn't interested in doing it, you know, so that's when they got John Buscema and Rudy Niebuhr's.
And those were nice, too.
But that was the end of Michael Ploog.
I think he went into animation.
He just disappeared. And I think it was 88 or 89 when First Comics, you know, brought him in to do those Lone Wolf and Cub covers. And they were making a big deal about the return of Michael Ploog. And then he did that on Classics Illustrated. But I don't know. It wasn't the same Michael Ploog to me. It seemed like, you know.
He did some Spirit.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Spirit. You mentioned that.
Yeah, those were actually pretty nice. I mean, it didn't have the same feel. It was a little bit more maybe refined. It didn't have the grittiness of the early stuff. But that early 70s stuff was awesome, actually.
Well, yeah, that's one thing with a lot of creators is when they first start out. I mean, when I started working, you know, when I got out of school and started working, I felt guilty doing the kind of work I do, because I'd be doing it home for free, you know. And in high school, I always had drudgery jobs, you know, just general jobs. And when I got out, I really felt guilty. I was coming in, I was happy. My boss, you know, I was working as assistant to, you know, the graphics guy at a silkscreen place. And he'd come in, you know, I'd walk in, he'd have all my assignments in the morning. I'd sit there and do them, and I thought, God, this is, you know, I can't believe I wasn't getting paid a lot, but I just get, man, I'd be doing this for free. This is what I do when I go home. And I think that's what happens when you first start doing comics, I imagine, is it's the excitement. You're putting everything you got into it. And a lot of creators, their early work, even if it's sometimes crude, that's some of their best. And I think after a while, they just start looking at it as a paycheck and feel like they got screwed, and they just kind of do surface work, you know, just kind of go through the motions.
Sometimes happens the same with musicians. Their early stuff is the best. Then after a while, either they run out of ideas, or you said they're going through the motions, or they become a cover band.
Yeah, they just keep redoing old hash, and there's no excitement or anything anymore.
Yeah, so. Anyway, we're going to listen to some music, right? Some Ron Ray?
Yeah, this is Ron, our friend Ron Ray. This is his band, The Jury.
All right, well, The Jury is out right now, so let's check it.
And that was The Jury with our friend Ron Ray.
The great Ron Ray. The amazing Ron Ray.
We were bagging on, we left work. He said something about it. Somebody had a good show. We just got off work today. He made a comment. And I said, well, I can tell you, Ron, you're never going to come on the show. You're just too crusty, you know. And he started making jokes about, you kids, get out of my lawn. And I said, we'll play you on the show, but you're never going to be on it.
You know, it was cool. I didn't know he was a musician. And then he was on, they had the talent show a couple of years ago. And he showed up with Mike playing.
Mike Salyers.
And he was very good, actually.
Well, he did it this last time, too. And Vicky Fernandez played hand drums.
I didn't see that one.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. It was a lot of fun. Ron has all these pictures. He was in the Tampa Bay area in different bands. And he ended up going to Austin, Texas for a while
with the band.
And at one point I said, why were you in Austin? I was trying to be a rock star, Don. But, you know, he was playing band after band, and, you know, he did quite a bit with them. I was surprised seeing the pictures. And, you know, our friend Steve Robinson was in a band, a really successful band in the area called The Headlights.
And he's playing tonight.
Yeah, he's playing. I thought it was next Friday. I didn't go. He opened for, what was that artist?
Oh, the great Richard Thompson.
You know,
wonderful guitar player. One of the best.
Oh, ever. Steve, whenever you say Richard Thompson, his eyes roll back in his head and he starts drooling all over the place. And I'll be honest with you, I never liked him.
Richard Thompson?
Yeah, I mean, he's good. I don't know.
I'll see if I can find you a nice collection.
Steve was always bringing in CD. Don, you got to listen to this. And I would listen to it. I mean, it's good, but, you know, sometimes certain artists, even if you think they're good, you just don't really enjoy listening to them.
Yeah, that's true, too. If it doesn't, like, grab you, then it's kind of like, well, that's nice, well-played, and good songwriting, but it just doesn't, like, you know. That kind of happened to me with the Captain and Tennille. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, well, you know, that's funny because I love them.
I know. That's why I was joking. I don't want to, like, you know, I don't want to step on your toes, you know, and I know about them and the Carpenters and all that stuff. I actually like the Carpenters, so whatever.
Yeah, they were pretty good.
Yeah. Anyway, getting back to comics.
Yeah.
So are you going to read the Watchmen?
The Watchmen
I will.
Prequels?
I am.
Well, you know, it's a funny story. I'm talking about creators' rights and stuff. Is all of us, we all looked at The Watchmen as a single thing. And when I heard about a prequel, everybody's like, oh, God, you know, this, you know, when it was rumors. And I said, well, they can do what they want. I'm not going to read it. Again, I go back to when Ted Turner was colorizing all the black and white movies in the 80s. And people were up in arms about it. And then one day at work, somebody said, I can't believe Ted Turner colorized the first 15 minutes of Wizard of Oz. And I jumped up like, what? And kind of find it was a joke, but, you know, it was like he missed the point. He had no clue. He was just blindly colorizing everything. And that was my reaction to the prequel. But then, you know, a couple of days later when I saw the covers online, even though I felt that way, I got really interested. And I was thinking, well, screw this. I wanted to get the Darwin Cook series, you know, the Minutemen. And I think it was Dr. Manhattan, you know, it was Adam Hughes did the cover.
Yeah, it was real nice.
It was really nice. And I was thinking, well, I'd like to see that. I don't know if I want to buy it. But then, you know, thinking about it, I guess it's the funny thing is you can have an idea of, you know, oh, that's wrong. But, man, when it comes out, if it looks good, you may just dive in and buy it anyway.
Yeah. You know, you talked about colorization of movies before, now you brought it back. I honestly don't have a problem with colorized movies because if you don't like it, you turn off the color. I mean, it's kind of like a way to get people to kind of look at these movies. And, you know, you can say that it's like, oh, you're destroying a piece of art. But the reality is it might get somebody to watch King Kong.
Yeah.
And then they become a fan. And then they realize later on, you know what, this is way better. I'm in black and white. It was meant to be in black and white. So I don't have a problem with it. And I've watched some things that they've done for DVD, and the technology is a lot better now, actually.
Well, there's two things on that. back in the day when that was happening, I didn't have any problem when I heard about them doing it. A lot of people I worked with were extremely upset about it. And some of them were, you know, getting VCRs and recording Casablanca, so they'd have it, you know, the way it was originally intended. I never minded black and white film. I've always, you know, as a matter of fact, when I was going to college, some movies were coming out in black and white again. Elephant Man, you know, that Lynch film.
They colorized that?
No, but I'm saying when it came out, it was in black and white.
Yes, it was, yes.
And it was beautiful black and white. It had a mood and a feel and a texture.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Oh, right.
And there was another movie that came out. It was in black and white.
Woody Allen did a couple of them.
Yeah, it came
Crimes and Misdemeanors, maybe?
Yeah.
Or Shadows and Fog or something?
One of those, but there was a few movies that were coming
Young
out in black and white.
Frankenstein?
Yeah, Young Frankenstein.
Now that's a great movie.
And that wouldn't have worked in color.
No, you know? No, no.
And, you know, when my daughter was small, one day I'm driving, and I just kind of laughed. Just to myself, I just thought of that putting on the Reds. And, you know, my daughter, I guess she was about four. She goes, Daddy, why were you laughing? And I was just thinking of a movie I saw before that was kind of funny. What was it? You know, she wouldn't leave me alone. So I was explaining to her that, you know, it was this movie that they tried to make look like an old Frankenstein movie. They did it in black and white. And I explained about Dr. Frankenstein in the original movie, you know, had all these surgeons and stuff out in the theater. And they pulled the curtain back and they had the monster there. And I said, it was really kind of like terrifying. And as this, you know, Young Frankenstein, he's in a tuxedo with a top hat dancing around, you know, singing Putting on the Ritz. And the monster, and, you know, she just thought that was hilarious. So we rented the movie and on tape, and she fell in love with it. She rented it I don't know how many times, and then eventually she got the DVD for her birthday, and it never leaves her side.
Wow, that's awesome.
It is, but I didn't, you know, I guess the thing was that some of the colorizing jobs they were doing in 1986 were not the best.
Well, you know what it is, too? It's like you don't really want to colorize Casablanca, but, you know, if you're going to colorize the killer shrews or the giant Gila monster, go for it.
Well, there were some movies I did see that were colorized on TV. You know, you watch afternoon movies and stuff, and I didn't give any thought. I just thought it was bad film. And then later I saw it in black and white. Oh, they colorized it. So, you know, and
it does have that pastel look to it. You know, like they can't get really strong.
Well, that changed.
They got better.
That same company that did it, I guess it was in the mid-90s, there was a Fox TV show, something about science. It was a virtual girl that came out of a computer. Two teenage boys had it. I never saw
it. Weird Science.
Oh, was it Weird Science?
Yeah, awesome and, movie.
Well, no, but it was a TV series.
Yeah, yeah, awesome TV show, too.
But I was reading about that in the newspaper, the local paper here, but they said that the way they did it was they filmed it in black and white, but I guess it was a tonal black and white.
No, that was a color show. There may have been some clips.
Well, no, they added the color to it.
The Weird Science TV show?
Yeah. They filmed it in tonal black and white and then added the color through a computer on top of it. It was the same two guys that did the Ted Turner old movies in color.
No.
But they kept saying that, well, it may be a different
series. It's a different thing, yeah. It's not the Weird Science TV show.
But the color I saw was staggering. And they kept saying it'll be like nothing you ever saw. It was vibrant, really strong color. But they said, hopefully the people will forgive us for what we did in the 80s.
Right.
But they were also explaining about the palette was very limited. I remember Macintosh, and we started working on them. You had 256 colors. That's as much as you get. And then when OS 8 came out, it was, I think later, OS 7, it was thousands of colors. And when OS 8 came out, it was millions of colors. Now it's just unlimited. But, you know, resolution gets higher. But they were saying back in 86, they had one flesh color, one flesh tone.
Oh, really? And so everybody looked the same color.
Well, it's like you mentioned the pastel quality of everything. But, you know,
that was all they had.
The technology and colorizing techniques completely changed. My brother is a teacher, and he was over at my house one time, and he, we watched that Miyazaki movie. Miyazaki. My Neighbor Totoro, the animated film.
Yeah, okay.
It was the Japanese, 20th Century Fox, you know, got it and dubbed it. And a friend of mine I work with, I collect Jackie Chan movies. And one of my favorite movies is Project A. Well, this friend of mine, she collected Hong Kong movies as well. When she found out I had it, she wanted to watch it. And then she stopped for a minute and said, "Wait a minute, is this movie dubbed?" "Well, it's in English," I said. "Oh, I hate dubbing with a passion." Okay.
I love dubbing.
Well, I don't mind, you know, when I got movies that were subtitled, that was fine. If I got them dubbed, they were fine. You got to remember, I was in the Philippines. It's when I was dating my wife in 1984. And we were at a movie theater. I saw two of the most horrifying English-speaking movies I ever saw in my life. The first was called When Children Kill Their Parents.
Gosh.
I remember the cab driver, you know, we were in another part of the Philippines. We got in the cab, and my wife explained to the guy we were looking for, do you have an English-speaking movie theater? Everywhere in the Philippines I went, they had the native language theater.
Tagalog.
And then they had an English theater. And so he took us to it, and I remember we got up there, he started laughing. "Oh, that's going to be a really nice movie, When Children Kill Their Parents." And then we got out of the cab and paid him. He's just laughing his head off. It was absolutely horrifying.
This movie sounds very interesting to me. Who's in this movie?
I saw the movie, but it was an American movie.
It's an American movie?
Here we go again.
Here we're going on a tangent.
Okay, this is a long episode, too. I apologize, everyone. But basically, the synopsis was there was this woman. She was a kept woman. There was a newscaster, a local newscaster. And he was a minor character, but he'd be on the air like the local news, you know, the anchor. And, you know, he had his own personality. Well, he had an apartment for her, a really nice apartment he kept her in. And, you know, he'd get off the news and come see her. The way I took it, he was married and had a family, but he kept her on the side. And he'd come in, he was a real, not to her, but he was a jerk about everything else. He's bagging on the sportscaster and how he made a mishap, and he was laughing about it, and he'd talk about office politics and stuff there. And the woman, after the guy left, she was watching TV, and they had some 17-year-old kid on trial for murder. And, you know, while she's watching it, she walks over the screen and she kisses him and leaves lipstick, you know, over his head image. And then she starts writing a letter. And he's, dear so-and-so, says, "I watched you on TV, and I can't believe it. I just gave you a great big wet one right on the TV. I even left my lipstick on it." "Now, what is this about?" "Well, basically, she was in love with this kid that was on trial for murder. He murdered his parents." And then it shows her, you know, while they're doing the voiceover for that, it shows her get ready one day. She wears a nice dress and a hat, and she struts into the courtroom. And, you know, it's a televised, you know, trial, and he's in the orange jumpsuit and all that, handcuffs, and she sits in the little area where all the spectators could sit. She's sitting there just chomping gum, you know, just kind of, you know, "Oh, isn't this fun?" And, you know, there's this big argument breakout, and somehow a fight occurs during this court thing, and somebody gets the bailiff's gun or the sheriff's gun or whatever. Somebody gets shot, and then she screams the guy's name, and she helps him get out of there. And then they take off. And that was a story. Basically, it was a love story between this kept woman and this 17-year-old kid that killed his parents. And, you know, there was good. I think at the end they were both shot dead, but they were both in love with each other. And the second movie they showed, we walked in. I don't know the title of that other movie, but it was an American. I guess it was dubbed, but it was like some kind of a European film, but it was showing Nazis, like in World War II.
Ooh.
And it shows this fight, but it was total 70s, you know, like TV
exploitation
quality.
Stuff.
Well, but it was like the same kind of quality that 1970s TV movies.
Yeah,
had,
I know what you mean.
Production quality. But it was about four people, a team. This really heavy, fat guy with a straggly beard. And he just looked like somebody you'd see in some local bar hanging out. You know, I mean, there was a woman, a real pale blonde woman, looked kind of sickly, and two other white men that I guess one was supposed to be smart and had glasses. I can't remember the fourth member, but the heavy fat guy was the leader. And like I said, we walked in and saw the end, and they're all Nazis. And then later on, they were fighting the Nazis. And then the whole thing ends with them on a some kind of cargo plane. You know, a couple of them have been shot. I think it's the fat guy had been shot. The woman was aside trying to help him. And they're flying the plane, and somebody makes a joke, and somebody else adds something else to it. And then the fat guy just looks at him, and he shoots him the bird. And he leaves it on the screen for 5 minutes, just doing that with his teeth grit. And they all stand there laughing like, isn't this guy cool? And the woman just kind of melts into his side, and she's laughing. All the other guys are laughing. It keeps going back to the guy with the finger there. And they're showing credits, and I thought,
dude, this movie is awesome. I might have to find this
movie. I was like, you got to be kidding me.
Did you recognize any of the actors?
No, they weren't even American. It was a dub movie from somewhere else, and it was just... But then after then the headliner, when Children Kill Their Parents, came on. And then when that finished...
Who was in that one?
Nobody I know of. It
was it Filipinos? Or
no,
was
it was American. It was an American movie.
And it was called... I got to look this movie
When Children Kill Their Parents. And but that was an American movie. And then when it came back up, it showed the... You know, after we saw that whole movie, it was the next movie, which again was these... four people fighting the Nazis. I don't know what country
that was
from.
The one where they're fighting the Nazis. Was it World War II?
Yeah, it was supposed to be World War II. Okay. Well, that was the only time they had Nazis in the war.
Well, I've seen movies where they're with new Nazis or revived Nazis.
Oh,
or,
no, this is actual World War II.
Okay, I'm a B-movie, nut job, so I've seen all sorts of, neo-Nazi and whatever movies.
Well, it's amazing. When you go overseas, you see things from the United States that you've never seen before.
Oh, that is totally cool.
I says, whoa, I wasn't aware of any of this stuff.
Not ready for prime time. So
I'm telling you, I'm starting to understand why people hate Americans on top of everything else. So it's because all of the crap that we won't get, they get stuck with.
Oh, they love it. They're just envious.
You know. Anyway, how did we get on this subject?
We were talking about dubbing and colorizing.
Well, anyway, when we went to the show, they were showing previews at one point between the movies. And I had never heard of Jackie Chan in my life. We get to the city, we stayed at the hotel, and we were eating in the restaurant there. And they had a little TV. And everybody in the restaurant stopped. It was a movie called Spiritual Kung Fu. It was a Jackie Chan film.
I remember that title.
Well, I have it if you ever want to watch it.
Yeah.
And
was it also called like Half a Loaf of Kung Fu? I remember one called Half a Loaf of Kung Fu.
There's another one called that, but this was one of Jackie Chan's first movies, Spiritual Kung Fu. And everybody, even the waiters and stuff in the restaurant, stopped and were watching the film. You know, I mean, they still do their job, but everybody's intently watching it. And I just thought it was kind of an odd film. Again, it was dubbed in English. And at one point, I guess another school or monastery came over and fought this school, like all other Kung Fu movies, and they got beat. And it shows all these monks, in a lotus position, meditating. And then Jackie Chan walks over and he goes, I can't believe this. You know, another school came over here, and they beat us, and you sit around and do nothing. Why don't you pray or something? And I thought, well, that's what they're doing, And there was some, I guess he was a Korean-American here that did a movie called They Call Me Bruce. And
I remember that guy.
Yeah, and basically, all through this show I saw, it showed on the ship one time. And
they still call me Bruce, yeah.
Yeah, is that what it was? They kept saying, every time there'd be these tough guys getting ready to mess with us, says, do you see me? Do you see my face? I'm Oriental. And they get scared thinking they knew Kung Fu and ran off, and, he didn't. So when a Jackie Chan film came out, oh, God, it's that guy again, And then, we're watching the film, and I just thought, it's another one of these really stupid, funny movies. And then my wife said, I like Jackie Chan. He's very funny. Yeah, I've seen him. And then she said, he's really good at martial arts, too. And then my mind just twisted, thinking, wait a minute, a guy's funny and he's good at martial arts at the same time? I'd never heard of that. And we stayed and watched that whole film, and I could not believe it. I watched the rest of the film with my mouth hung open trying to figure out how he did these things.
Oh, yeah.
Well, at the movie theater, they showed the opening to the previews to Project A. It had all the bicycles. Have you ever seen that movie?
Project A?
He's a Hong Kong Coast Guard in like 1800s.
No.
Okay, well, get ready. It's probably my favorite Jackie Chan film. But it shows him in this alleyway on a bicycle fighting all these guys with a bicycle. And I just couldn't believe it. And I kept telling my wife, I wish they showed this film instead of these other two. Well, after I left the Philippines, my wife wrote me a letter that her and her best friend went to see Project A, and you know, it was pretty good. I was always trying to find it in any store, you know, never saw it, ever. And then finally, I guess it was about 96, it came out on tape. And it was dubbed. I bought it, and I remember my daughter and I watched it. My wife and I and my daughter watched it. And then later on, my wife said, she'd ask my daughter, what's your dad doing? He's watching Project A again. I watched it every day for I don't know how long.
My gosh, I
never get tired of it, but it was dubbed. And it reminded me of Max Flash or Popeye, how they did the voices.
The
people that did the dubbing didn't respect the material, and it sounded like it was three people, a woman and two different men.
Dubbed in Hong Kong, probably, by Australians.
Yeah,
possibly.
Or Australia. Yeah. But, like I said, nevertheless, it just had a character all its own. When my friend went and watched it, she said, I hate dubbing with a passion. Well, my brother, when he came up one time, he saw My Neighbor Totoro, which is dubbed. And he fell in love with the film. Well, you know, he takes a lot of students on school trips, and he always gets a bus with, you know, the videos and stuff. And he gets movies. He used to let the students bring whatever movie they wanted, and he said he was getting in trouble with the school because they were bringing some questionable films. And so basically, he was always on a search for films that would interest people that wouldn't be objectionable. And, you know, when he saw that, he said, oh, that'd be really good. So, you know, he got it, you know, played it on the trip. Well, one of his students was a girl from Japan. And she was, you know, she saw, was delighted, telling him all about Miyazaki. And my brother said something about, well, Disney got the rights to do all the Miyazaki films there. They'd done a really good job. But they were going to do Totoro and completely redo the voices and everything. And on one of the forums, this is back in the 90s, they said they were really surprised at it because Fox did a really good job. It says people that even hate dubbing thought it was good. Well, it was, and the Disney one is good as well. But my brother asked her about that. She goes, well, he says, I like it done as it was originally intended. And, you know, she mentioned that, you know, if it was done in English, she'd prefer to see it in English instead of dubbed in Japanese. And he says, if it was done in Japanese, I'd rather see it that way. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking only one language, I can't agree. But when I started seeing some of these movies, you know, subtitled, I was really surprised at how different it is. Like Jackie Chan's Police Story. There's an actress called Maggie Chung, which plays his girlfriend. Well, I always saw him in the dub versions, and I always referred to her as Jackie Chan's whiny girlfriend. It's always, oh, Jackie, oh, you know, all the time, like olive oil. And I always found it irritating. And when I saw it dubbed, it completely changed the whole dynamic of the picture. Because even though she's doing the same things, it's her voice and her acting, and she's not whiny at all. She's basically, you know, a girl trying to deal with the fact that her boyfriend is this cop and all this crazy trouble. And that's when I started learning differences. I found I do prefer, you know, even when I saw Project A, the way it was originally, you know, done is completely different. So I guess that's the thing with colorized movies. I'd prefer to see it the way it was originally done. A lot of times, say Casablanca, it was done darkly, and it's hard to color.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Sometimes even with comic books, talk about Alan Davis, as I do all the time. When he first started doing American work, it was on, I think, Batman and the Outsiders. And I was really surprised. It looked kind of like a coloring book. And I was reading an interview later. He did start changing that. But he said that was a mistake of his own. Because in English comics, they're always, or British comics, they're black and white. and they're really nice the way he did them. When he came to the United States, he opened up his style, thinking the colorist would come in and add more, like they do now with the computer, you know, rendering more. And they realized just how open and flat it was, so you know, he started adding more detail and, you know, more this and that. But I've seen sometimes they take old black and white comics and color them. Sometimes it's not always the best. Sometimes it's just too much, too muddy or something. Sometimes I don't mind. I never minded when they took Jaime Hernandez or Gilbert Hernandez comics and colorized those. But to me, it depends. Some comics, if they were done in color, I don't prefer to see them in black and white, you know, like they do sometimes.
Right.
Sometimes I don't mind. It adds a different element to it.
I mean, my opinion is that I prefer to see, in most cases, I prefer to see the movie, whatever it is, as I saw it originally.
Yeah.
Like if it was dubbed, that and I liked it, that's the version that I like. If you watch the subtitled version, like you said, the voices might be different. You'll find nuances in it that you didn't get before. But I always go back to the first one that I saw because it's the one that made the strongest impression on me for whatever reason. Like I can go, I'm like, again, a horror movie fan. Like there's a movie that I was watching the other day with a friend of mine. And I originally saw it, and it was called The Werewolf versus the Vampire Woman. Great title. They redid it. I mean, they didn't redo it. They released it subtitled version. And it's probably a better version of it. But the opposite happened with me than what happened with you. You said you liked the voices. When I saw the subtitled version, you got the original Spanish voices, and they were in that really strong Castilian Spanish. And I, being Spanish, can understand what they're saying, but the accent, hate to say it, but it was really annoying to me.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like, well, okay. I mean, I understand what they're saying. I read the subtitles. It's fine. But I kind of like the dub version better just because, I don't know, it works for me, but I can understand your point of view. They can, the interpretation of it in the dub version can be a completely different movie. Same thing with subtitles, too, because I've read the subtitles and listen to what they're saying in Spanish and as opposed to English. And sometimes I've seen them where it's like he might be saying it's $10,000, and in subtitles it'll say like it's $50,000. Sometimes,
yeah, well,
you know, they're a little off.
Now, that's the other thing. Like, say, Project A, when I had it on tape, and I, even though the people that dubbed it didn't respect the material, it's great fun.
Yes.
And but they did change, you know, again, some of the characters' names. In the dub version, one of the guys that's with Jackie Chan, they call him Big Mouth. That's his name, Big Mouth. Well, in the actual version, when they're showing the subtitles, they call him Jaws. And he's not as funny. He's still a great character.
Right.
But, you know, it was the dubbing that they did. They kind of had all these little in-jokes and stuff. And, you know, my daughter was small. She always giggled and squealed whenever you talked. That was her favorite character. I've seen other films that they dubbed to Jackie Chan's, and sometimes it's a train wreck. It's not funny. Project A is the one that was just, you know.
It was good, okay.
And, I mean, there's others. The Police Story films were dubbed, and they were fine. You know, I found, again, I liked them better when it was a subtitle, because, you know, you can hear the inflection of the actors' voices and stuff and how they really meant, whereas, basically, a lot of times when they're dubbed, it's just three people, and sometimes you can just tell they're just cranking movie out, not understanding the material.
There was a movie, and I think it's a Godzilla movie. I can't remember which one it was, but I'm pretty sure that the guy who dubbed it did most of all the male voices. Maybe they got a couple of women to do the female voices, but I got a feeling, I can't remember which one it was, but the dubber did most of the guy's voices. And when I was a kid, you don't notice it because you're like all wrapped up in like the destruction and the monster. But when you watch it for like the third time, you go, isn't that Paul Frees again or whatever the guy was? Isn't that him changing his voice? Nah, maybe there was two people, but yeah. No, you're right about that. And they were radio guys too, so they were like,
you know, it's Now I'm forgetting my point all of a sudden. Thank you, Al.
No, it's basically, like I said, it depends on when you saw it, what you thought about it, and sometimes the subtitling improves it, sometimes it doesn't.
Oh, yeah, the one. Yeah, thanks, I got my train of thought again. That's why we're friends.
That's right.
No, there's a Jackie Chan film, a lady I trained with, she, like myself, she's a huge Jackie Chan fan, and we'd always talk about the movies. One of the movies I had read about that I'd never seen up to that point was City Hunter. It was based on a Japanese comic book or manga.
Okay.
But he did a movie playing a character. And, you know, when I asked her about it, she said it was actually pretty good. And one thing she talked about was they're on a cruise ship. And she said he has to fight these two tall American terrorists. And they're fighting. There's a movie theater on the cruise ship. And they're showing Bruce Lee's Game of Death when he's fighting Jabbar.
Yeah.
And she said it's kind of funny because Bruce Lee can't, these two guys are tall, and he can't fight them, and he's basically just getting beat. Then he starts looking at the screen and seeing what Bruce Lee's doing, so he starts doing that. And I, really, that sounds fun. Well, I was at Walmart, you know, they had the movie there, City Hunter. Really? So I went and bought it, took it home. It's pretty good, you know, and that the movie theater scene is what makes that whole movie. And I remember at the end of it, when he's finished, he turned around the screen and said, "Hey, thanks." And then Bruce Lee looks at the screen and says, "No problem, you're not bad." And then Jackie Chan stops and looks back at the screen with this, like, "What?" It was funny, you know. And anyway, I bought it and I told my friend about it. And she goes, "Oh, do you have it?" Because she saw it on tape. She lived in Seattle, Washington. So I brought it in, and she watched it. And she came back kind of embarrassed. Said, "What's wrong?" Because I can't believe I told you I ever liked the movie. That was so silly, so goofy. And she kept talking about the music. They had this music, do-do-do-do-do, all the way through the film. And I was just too over the top. It was too, kind of like how they did the songs in the Watchmen movie. It was like a jukebox all the time. And I said, "Well, you know, the movie theater part was fun." And she says, "Yeah, I was..." But then I started reading it, basically, when they dubbed that movie, it was zany and over the top. And they added the music. It's not the original music to it. And seeing the original, now I understand why she was embarrassed. The original one was a lot better of a movie. Mm. Again, it was the actor's inflection. There was a lot of whining from the... A lot of times when they dub Hong Kong films, the women always whine and moan throughout the whole thing. Again, like olive oil did on the Popeye cartoons.
Right.
So, you know, respect the material and stay with it. And don't just have three people. The only time it was ever great was when they did the Speed Racer cartoon.
Oh, and the Astro Boys, too.
But, you know, that's...
And Prince Planet. Prince Planet was dubbed in Miami.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you know that?
In Miami. Because at the end of it, you'll see this guy called Manny San Fernando, and the voice talent, the lady who did Prince Planet, her name was Bobby Byers, and she was an actress in Miami, and I've seen interviews with her, and she actually, yeah, it was done in Miami.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And a lot of there was a Santo one. It was called Samson and the Wax Museum, but a lot of these Mexican early horror movies that they came here, like the Monsters Demolisher, Attack of the, what was it, the Curse of the Aztec Mummy, all dubbed in Miami at some place called Sound Lab Studios in Coral Gables. Yeah.
Oh, wait. You mean Santo was dubbed by Cubans in Miami?
No, it was dubbed by Americans in Miami.
Does the Mexican government know about this?
Now they do. Yeah, there was a guy called K. Gordon Murray, and he imported him over, and he redubbed him in Miami, because he was from Miami. Yeah, I don't know about Astro Boy, but Prince Planet was dubbed in Miami by Americans. But Manny San Fernando was the director of the dubbing.
Well, you know, that's the thing with
Or at least I think that's
the Speed Racer. The guy that did the voice to Speed Racer, he was, you know, when you get those DVDs. You know,
Peter Fernandez.
They were great, because he was talking about he had a company that dubbed the shows, and it was basically him and one other guy, and again, a woman. And they got the rights to the Speed Racer, so they brought them in to him and said, with Japanese television, basically the show runs for a year, and that's it, it's gone. And he said, that's just the standards of Japanese TV. And he said basically he took it, and he took, I think it was 50...
yeah, it's probably 50 episodes.
I think it was, yeah, 50, 58 or something. And he re-edited them and made 65, you know, for American syndication.
Right.
And so anyway, he put the whole thing together, and then he dubbed it. And he was making a joke that whenever he did it, he basically chose which characters he would be. And he was always the good guys. And, of course, the woman did all the female voices. And the other guy ended up getting Dan Dynamo and, you know, and some of the other stuff. But I never even watch them now. I mean, I can understand it's three people, but they actually did a pretty good job. And as a 9-year-old kid watching these in Texas, the one question I wonder was the rhythm of it, because they always talk like, I told you, never go back over this way again. I told you never go there. Oh, I wish Rex would come back. I really miss him.
they have to match the mouth inflections.
Well, that's it. But when I was a kid, I didn't know all these cartoons were Japanese. I kept thinking, why does Speed Racer, everybody talk so fast? My brother used to ask me that, you know, and sometimes we'd imitate it. But the theme song is just genius.
Oh, that is a great song.
I've got it on my iPod.
Even the Astro Boy is genius, and so is Prince Planet, too, for that matter.
You know, my daughter and I used to, when she was little, we used to get hairbrushes and sit there and sing in the mirror, you know, here he comes, here comes Speed Racer. And then we'd start changing things up. You know, we'd start singing. It says, okay, now the cheerleaders. And she'd go, Speed Racer, yay! But,
And those guys that dubbed Speed Racers, they went and they would dub the horror movies, too, and some of the Godzilla movies.
Yeah.
You can hear their voices. and the funny thing is that you're watching a horror movie, and you hear this one guy in it, and he's got Speed Racer's voice, and it kind of like, oh, man, that's Speed Racer. Oh, my God.
Well, you know, I heard on the Internet you can listen to the, I guess Speed Racer was called Mach Go Go Go.
Mm-hmm.
Which explained why he had a G on his shirt.
Yeah.
But his name was Go Mifune. But the theme song, it's not the American. It's kind of slow and droning. It's horrible.
No, it's not horrible, but yeah.
It was horrifying. But the guy that did all the dubbing was saying that to this day, people look at the American version of Speed Racer as the universal one. And,
Did you see the Speed Racer movie?
No. Well, somebody at work kept showing me the car. Says, hey, this is the car. Well, it looked kind of neat. And then I was thinking, okay, maybe. Again, as I said, I prefer the stuff in comic books or animation.
Yeah, yeah.
And with a couple of exceptions. But I thought, well, maybe it could be neat. And I was just going to wait and see. And then when I started seeing it advertised, the previews, it looked kind of like a video game to me.
It did look like a video game.
And I never bothered seeing it. Some of the students I had at the karate school, you know, they loved it, you know, the kids. And I know I've never watched it. I was kind of amazed at how they took John Goodman and Susan Sarandon and kind of made them look like, you know, Pops Racer and, you know, Mrs. Racer. So, I mean, the video game thing kind of killed it for me, but I guess they were looking at a different market, you know.
I think it was done by the guys who did The Matrix.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. I saw the film at the store for $5, but I still didn't buy it.
I should watch it if it comes on.
Have you ever seen it?
No, I haven't. I had the same exact feeling as you did. It looked like a video game.
Well, and they brought the cartoon back. Nickelodeon was showing it, the new Adventures.
Oh, okay.
But, I mean, it looked... It didn't look like Speed Racer. You know, look, a modern anime type. I think it was an American thing, but they made it look like anime.
Oh, okay, all right.
But I don't know. You know,
I didn't see the Astro Boy movie either.
Well, that one, I think they, even though it was computer generated, I think they tried to stay faithful to the old material. The Speed Racer New Adventures, I just saw parts of it once, and I had no interest. Just leave it the way it was.
Yeah, nice, good old black and white.
Yeah. Well, no, well, you know, Speed Racer was color.
Well, not Astro Boy.
Though. Oh, no, no.
But you know what's funny? Going back to the colorization things, and I can't think specifically which movie it was, but I was watching some movie the other day that I hadn't seen since I was a kid, and I guess we only have black and white TV set. And I go, wow, this was in color? I didn't know this was in color. I just remember it in black and white. And it's kind of a weird experience. It doesn't have the same feel to it anymore.
Well, when they were colorizing all those movies, I remember people were criticizing. Somebody had said that people don't watch them when they're on TV. Now, as we talked about, a lot of us just had black and white TVs in the early 60s. And our next door neighbor bought a color TV. And we went over there at night and watched all the TV shows. Well, it was fun, you know. My next door neighbor was my best friend, you know, and it was always kind of like a party. Well, every night we'd leave the house, you know, and go over there and watch all the TV shows. And I don't know, after three or four nights, I was 6 years old, and my parents were, well, come on, let's go. I said, I don't want to go. I want to stay here. I was watching TV. And Mom said, don't you want to watch in color? And I thought, I guess I never gave it a thought. I wasn't interested in going over. I want to watch TV. So they let me stay home, you know, and they went over and watched it. Well, you know, eventually we got a color TV, which is fine. I guess the only time I remember even noticing it was color was me and my next-door neighbor were messing with the dials when nobody was around. It was Gomer Pyle, and we were turning the hue and the contrast and up. And they came out and got onto us. Well, it was fun. And we were watching the Gomer Pyle. They're all standing in front of the barracks, all in, you know, formation. And we basically, the khaki uniforms turned out this really luscious brown, and their skin tones turned a really cool olive green. Oh, and that's how we were watching it. And, you know, they got onto us, were changing it. So, well, we liked it this way. And then both our moms kept saying, you made them green. Well, to me, you know, we were 6 years old. I mean, you know.
Yeah, sure. What the hell?
And, you know, they made us change it back. That's the only time I really remember even enjoying a color. You know, you know, I guess I was about 9 years old. By this time, most everybody had a color TV. But one of my friends at school, I'd always go to his house after school and watch TV with him. And it was always fine. I never really thought about it. It was a black and white TV set. The only reason I remember that now was they bought a color TV. And that's all they talked about was color. And I'm sitting there, you know, we were watching TV, and all of a sudden I Love Lucy came on, which, you know, everybody watched. And that came on, and they're playing it. And she goes, oh, Philip, can you turn it to a color? Or she says, does it mess up? And he's like looking at all the dials. Well, I think it's okay. And I said, this is how it is. Oh, it's in black and white. Can you find a color program? And I'm thinking, this is irritating. Can we just watch this? So, you know, they had to search around for a color program. To me, I mean, I like color. Don't get me wrong. But I don't mind them when they're black and white.
Oh, I love that.
And my wife and daughter, when my daughter was small, was asking me one time, because I was watching AMC, all these old movies and stuff.
Yeah, back when they were good.
Yeah, back when it was still AMC.
Before commercials.
And
well, The Walking Dead. You
know. Well, yeah, they became a different station, but you know, the classic AMC, it was commercial free, and it was all these old movies.
Yeah, what Turner Classic Movies is now.
Yeah, they kind of turned into AMC, but like I said, I really enjoyed it. And one time, my daughter says, "Why do you like black and white movies?" Well, they're good. Well, my wife didn't like to watch them either. Now, again, she watched black and white shows in the Philippines. But to her, she prefers the color. And it was the W.C. Fields movie. And I'm sitting there watching it. Finally, they came in and sat on the couch with me and watched the last, you know, 15 minutes of it. They're both squealing and giggling the whole time. You know, he's classic. And when it's finished, they said, oh, it's over? And I said, why do you watch black and white movies? And they sat there and looked at me. I mean, you know, you can't judge it by that. My daughter's changed since then. She loves black and white films.
Right.
And stuff. But the Powerpuff Girls, they did a movie. And at one point, they go to the moon. And everything's quiet. There's no sound. And it's all in black and white. And but each Powerpuff Girl, they made their eyes a color, you know, which was kind of neat looking. Well, me, whenever I watch something on DVD, I have to watch the audio track. And they were talking about that black and white section. They said that they put that in there to show the, you know, otherworldliness and everything, and they got rid of the sound, which is kind of neat. And they said the people behind the movie said, wait a minute, you can't do this. You got to add some color. Kids won't watch it. And then they started talking, yeah, kids can't see black and white. They can only see color. And that was a running joke with my daughter when she's little. But, Dad, you remember, I can't see black and white. You like Young Frankenstein? She loved those Flasher Popeye cartoons.
Oh, those were the best.
You know, I was surprised she knew them, because once in a while on Cartoon Network they show them. She goes, oh, this one's a good one. Have you seen this before? Oh, yeah, they show it on Sundays. What? I never knew that. But she religiously watched those, you know, wow. Black and white or not. So, you know, I mean, like I said, I like color. I don't want to, you know. I guess the whole thing is now is you got the HD, which is nice. But I enjoy TV before HD. And the thing
I got, that, I got the flat screens.
what
I mean, I've got the old tubes. I don't know.
Well, they're fine, too. But what irritated me is when you start seeing something on HD, Lost, that TV series Lost.
It gives it a really weird look to it.
Well, you know, my wife is like, oh, honey, look at this. You know, and they're showing Hawaii, and you can see every bit of dew
every
on
detail,
all the leaves and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, at first it's really distracting because you're trying to watch the show. Even if you enjoy the visuals, you're
thinking,
this is just irritating.
Exactly. No, I agree. It becomes more of a spectacle almost, more than a real movie.
Well, I had a professor in college. He was taking us through this gallery looking at work, and there was a watercolor. It was actually, I thought, really nice. It was a small one, but it was a clear stream with pebbles on the banks. And, you know, it was all, you know, browns and greens and blues. Really fantastic. And it, even though it was, it looked like a ink and watercolor, it looked pretty real. And when my professor got to that one, he looked and he said, he stopped and paused for a minute. He goes, okay, this person went crazy with a magnifying glass. And then he was explaining about when you look at it, even though it was nice, it was a balanced and composed drawing, it had great skill. He said, every single section in it is exactly the same, like a comic book, which, you know, I like. But he said, that's not how your eye works. And he said the way they should have done it was you focus on one part and the rest of it would be kind of
blurry.
Yeah, not as fine-tuned. Well, that's how I see, I guess now it's the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
I've seen that at the stores. I was watching some martial arts film, The Protector, that Tony Jaa film. It's staggering. You know, when that helicopter goes through that building, you can see every shard of glass. You can even see initials on some of the tile that's torn out. But I'm like, well, I don't walk around the planet looking at things like that. To me, it's a little too distracting, but, you know.
I miss the graininess of film, the texture.
You know, sometimes I miss that, too.
I mean, it's like you're watching some of these movies, and it looks like you're looking through the mirror. And that's great, but I like there to be a distance between me and the movie. I don't want to be in the movie. I want to watch the movie.
Well, I don't know. 10,000 BC, I kind of wanted to be in the movie, especially when Raquel Welch showed up.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, in that Speed Racer movie, like, if, you know, Christina Ricci's in it, so if I could be in that, too, I'd enjoy it.
Or
that.
If I could have drove the Mach 5, I'd want to be in it. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's rethink what we were just saying.
Yeah, we take it all back. Oh, God. So we're going to talk about comics. Are we going to talk about the grand finale? We will talk about comics again.
Well, Dallas, he couldn't make it. He was coming. He couldn't make it again. And so we were just putting a show out because no more Filipino movies, guys.
Sorry, dude.
We did it again.
Sorry, dude.
So this is a marathon episode.
This is like a 2 hour.
Oh, jeez.
A 2 hour special Family Ties or something.
But. I picked up at the store. I'm a big Alan Davis fan, as I mentioned earlier, and I just found out he's doing Captain America with Ed Brubaker. And they're really nice. Alan Davis is, it doesn't matter who writes a story. You seem like when Alan Davis draws it, it's a fast read. Smooth storytelling, and every single thing he adds in this, it seemed like he really thinks out all the characters, floating islands, whatever he puts in, even glasses and keys left on the table, he really thinks things through. But the one thing, even though he always shows really dynamic stuff, you know, superhuman people, it's subtle things he does that always blows my mind in it. And this one, at the very beginning, Captain America is fighting somebody, you know, Captain America, because the super soldier serum is perfect being. He has, you know, perfect movement. It's just fantastic. And at one point, he loses the serum, and he reverts back to a regular human being, you know, wearing the uniform. And what surprised me, I've seen people do this before when I was a kid. And when they do that, all of a sudden he turns this really scrawny, sickly-looking, you know, 20-year-old that looks like, you know, he's a starving elder in India or something. And when Alan Davis drew this, you can see a difference. It's like he doesn't fill out the costume anymore, but he's still a fine-looking human being. But that's what surprised me. It's very subtle how he did it. But you can, you know, just glance at it and you notice the difference.
Is that inks by Mark Farmer, too?
Yeah, it's always Mark
Farmer. They're like a team.
Yeah,
pretty
it was
much.
Mark Farmer, and at one point, Paul Neary for a long time. It was Alan Davis and
right,
Paul Neary.
Paul Neary, yeah.
And then I think Mark Farmer, I think he inked him earlier.
Everything I've seen lately by them.
Yeah, well, Mark Farmer started, I guess, in the 90s. Paul Neary stopped, and Mark Farmer started doing it.
Now, Mark Farmer, not to be confused with Mark Farner, who was lead singer for Grand Funk Railroad.
Grand Funk Railroad, who was awesome.
They were awesome. I have a video there. I got to show that to you. But anyway,
like
we're going off
that.
On another tangent.
<we go>. Yeah. Grand Funk. Yeah, Mark Farner left the band and found religion, and they never got along again.
I think they've toured since, but...
Not the same.
Not the same. Anyway.
Well, anyway, that's... It's
now
good.
You've got two yeah. issues there. This is a mini series, right? That's not finished yet.
I don't know if it's a mini series. I saw them at the store. I got 6 and 7, and I thought, well, I want all of them. And I looked at 5, and it's by somebody else. So,
oh.
I'm guessing it's a series. But
did
Alan
you get
Davis
those at Comics World?
No, Yancey Street.
Was it at Yancey Street?
You and I were at Yancey Street.
All right.
But yeah, it's two issues. It's actually really good.
I like the ones that Chris Samnee did, too, but that was a different Captain America.
Captain America Bucky. Yeah,
those are nice too.
Those are really nice.
I mean, for people that say they're you know, comic books, you know, the artists and stuff, there's a lot of really good artists working in comics today. The problem is there's so many comic books that everybody's kind of got diluted. You know, there's no Jack Kirby, even though you could say maybe whoever, I don't know off the top of my head, but there might be like a top artist now. There's a lot of really good artists out
right.
there.
Well, that's one thing we talk about. When I go to some stores, like not here in Florida, Yancey's a bit different. But I used to go to stores, and they'd have, you know, all the comics they could get, and they'd always have stuff like Star Reach and, you know, fanzines and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And here in Florida, nobody carries them, and they said they just can't sell them. Well, I would have bought them.
They could sell them to you. Maybe they don't know us.
Maybe, yeah. Well, and the thing is, maybe there's just not enough of us to make it worth their while. But to me, that's one thing that kind of destroys the comics, because everybody's got something that they like that, you know, maybe not be the
norm.
Yeah, that most people would enjoy.
Well, too. I mean, from talking with and working in comics for a while. The budgets are so tight that they really can't take chances on just having something for the store because it may sit there forever unless we walk in there
right.
and buy it.
But, you know, like I said, I went back, you know, in September. I was in Oklahoma, and I was really shocked when I went to some of the stores. They were really big, and they basically just had a whole spectrum of everything. And, you know, I bought a couple of series from Gilbert Hernandez that, you know, and the Dollar Box. And the guy that ran the store said, oh, I love the Hernandez brothers. And I don't know if those are really big sellers. It wasn't Love and Rockets, but it didn't matter to him. He bought them just because he loved them and had them, you know, in the Dollar Box. I was happy to get them.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
But, yeah, there is a lot of stuff.
What about the Legion?
Yeah, Walt Simonson, again, is another one I just absolutely love. And if you like Walt Simonson, he's got a fan page on Facebook, and he's always posting sketches of, you know, old sketches and projects he's working on. And he started posting Legion of Superhero panels and pages. It just looked phenomenal. And I was excited, and I found out it came out. I asked my local comic shop to save it. They did. And I picked it up last weekend. It looks good, but I have to say I was a little disappointed in it. I mean, the work's spot on. Dan Green inked it. I actually prefer... He inked it really well. I mean, I'm looking at it. It gives
it a softer edge, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm looking at, you know, one of my friends way back in the past, when they announced that Walt Simonson was going to do Thor, they said that tentatively he's going to write and draw it, and he's going to try to ink it. And my friend says, I hope so, because nobody can ink Simonson like Simonson. And they said Terry Austin came close, but it still wasn't the same. Well, I agree. Terry Austin did a really good job.
Yeah, he did.
And Terry Austin was one of those people I've always heard people say, and I agree, that he can ink anybody and make them look good, no matter who it is. And he doesn't cover up their style. He just adds to it. But this one right here, Dan Green, I think, did a really good job, but it does kind of cover up Walt Simonson a bit.
I hadn't seen Dan Green's name in comics in a long time.
Yeah, I was surprised. And when I say that, he did a really nice work.
He used to do some inks on Gene Colan that were nice, too.
Yeah. Well, he inked John Byrne.
Doctor Strange.
He inked John Byrne at one point.
John Byrne, yeah.
As a matter of fact, I always associate Terry Austin with John Byrne. I like that team. And Gil Kane one time made a comment that John Byrne and Terry Austin basically had a really strong influence on each other, you know.
Yeah, and, I can see that.
But in an interview one time, after all this was going on, they asked John Byrne his favorite inker, and he said he liked Dan Green. And he said, basically his comment was that Dan Green inks the way John Byrne would ink if he was inking his own work, if he had time to do it. Well, he did a really nice job. I liked him as well. I think he's one of Dallas's favorites.
Dan Green?
Yeah, Dan Green.
Okay.
But the other thing I don't care for on this is the lettering. It's actually pretty neat, but for some reason it just takes away.
Is it machine lettering?
Yeah, it's machine. And like they have introductions to characters, and it's a different type of lettering. It's put in color. And
I see it, yeah.
It's a little blatant. Now, in the OMAC book that, you know, Keith Geffen's doing, that I just keep going on about, it's the same type of lettering. For some reason with OMAC, it seems to work. It's, you know...
You know why? Because John Workman was a guy who used to, I think, letter.
Yeah, Walt Simonson. Well, they're a team
and
as well.
He was pretty damn good, John Workman.
Well, John Workman and Walt Simonson always try to ink each other, or work with each
other
all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And but, you know, there's times where they can. And this is just one issue. Walt Simonson.
It's a one-shot only?
Well, it's, issue 5. Paul Levitz is writing the Legion of Superheroes.
Right.
You know, him and Walt... what was it? Walt Simonson said that him and Paul Levitz do a Legion thing every 15 years, you know.
Okay.
But, like I said, it's worth getting. I mean, it still shines through, but I would have liked the package a little different for Walt Simonson, but...
Okay, well...
Anyway, so yeah, we talked about comics, but not really in depth.
Yeah, I didn't read anything this week, so... I did read a few things, but I can't really comment on them yet because they're incomplete little stories here and there. So I'll do something for the next time. Plus, we've been on for like almost 2 hours now, the epic show that this is. So.
Yeah, I wonder how many people actually sat through the whole thing.
Yeah, we want to know. We want comments from you people out there. We want you to tell us what you think. So anyway. I think that's it.
Yeah, thank God. That's about it. Hopefully the rest of us will be back together again the next time.
Yeah. And in the meantime, read more comics and watch more dub movies.
Yeah, fine.